Bienvenue and welcome to Akeem's Dream Show. My name is Akeem the Dream, also known as Brown Sugar Supreme, also known as The Dark Knight Batman. I'm Batman. This show is a variety show because I had a lot of ideas growing up and wrote them down, and my curiosity is insatiable. And you'll notice that I have a lot of random ideas and subjects, but I think that's what makes it fun. Variety is the spice of life, and I like to keep it spicy, and you will find that out very quickly. Remember, folks, never grow old with no stories to tell. And it's finally time to spice things up. Let's go.
Check this out.
George, you know that woman just looked at you.
So what? What am I supposed to do?
Go talk to her.
Elaine, bald men with no jobs and no money who live with their parents don't approach strange women.
Well, here's your chance to try the opposite. Instead of tuna salad and being intimidated by women, chicken salad and going right up to them.
Yeah, I should do the opposite. I should.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another episode of Akeem's Dream Show. And that first clip from Seinfeld's one of my favorite episodes of all time, because George, he goes, approaches that girl. Later, he gets a job with the New York Yankees. It's this whole bit. And I think the idea of that show is very profound, that if you do the opposite of common knowledge, or in this sense, intuition, intuitive ideas, if you go against the grain on those things, a lot of times you'll end up being right, right? A lot of people who are successful, they come up with an idea that doesn't seem obvious in the moment. How many inventions were invented and then people were like, oh man, I should have thought of that. Why didn't I think of that? Because it wasn't intuitive. It was counterintuitive. It wasn't obvious until it was obvious. And that's what counterintuitive ideas are. As soon as I go through this list of stuff, you're going to realize, hey, holy shit, like this makes a lot of sense, but why don't we think that, right? I think our monkey mind puts us in a position where we have to think that the common sense and the obvious is the right answer in every time, in every sense of the word. And that goes back to education, which is a counterintuitive idea to think that education is going to provide us with the right way of thinking for the world, which in my opinion, lately what I've seen from education, the education system I went through, it kind of does the opposite. It almost makes you less prepared for the real world. Things like remembering stuff and dumping your mind out on a test to answer questions or A, B, C, or D. You figure out how to hack the system, but you don't figure out how to think. I remember Steve Jobs talking about law school. Steve Jobs is obviously the founder of Apple. He said that I would love to go to law school as a rich entrepreneur, tech Silicon Valley billionaire, because law school teaches you how to think and how to think in counterintuitively in some senses. Because what you pursue eludes you. Whatever you try to get will run from you, right? You don't catch a butterfly, it lands on you. If you want someone to be interested in you, you kind of have to appear uninterested. Or as the kids say these days, or as they've always said, you have to be cool. The first counterintuitive idea I ever heard was maybe 10 years ago when they were talking about legalizing drugs, like carte blanche across the entire gambit of narcotics and making anything that was Schedule One Schedule Nothing, right? We're talking serious drugs, smack, heroin, any of the hardest drugs you could think of, just removing it and making it completely redundant from the system. Because if you were to legalize everything, and I think they tested this out in one Swedish or Nordic country where they have the lowest levels of drug abuse anywhere in the world, and it's because nothing is, I think it's Amsterdam actually, but it's because nothing is illegal. So it's kind of like when you're growing up and you're a kid and you're like, hey, mom, what can I do? Or dad, can I do this? If they do the whole reverse psychology thing and they say, hey, you can do whatever you want, you're less likely to break the rules because you have more reign, you have more liberty. If every drug is illegal, the tinge or the allure of the drug becomes less sexy because anyone can do it. It kind of is like a demand and scarcity principle. So if you make drugs illegal, apparently, they won't be abused. That's counterintuitive, right? Because you think that the enforcement of the drug being a Schedule One or whatever would make it less desirable because you could potentially go to jail. But that's not how humans work, right? We are reward and danger seekers, thrill seekers. I mean, maybe not anymore with the way that we're all kind of turning to video games and our cell phones. But if you go back down to our basic genetics and our basic wiring, we are wired and tuned to kind of go against the grain, to explore, to try things, to break things. And I think that's important. I think it's interesting. So I'm going to break this episode down into two components. The first component and the first kind of counterintuitive ideas are ones that I found on the internet that I thought were interesting, but I didn't come up on my own. The next kind of section of this episode is going to be the ones that I've actually come up with and that I've observed. The first one I've already mentioned is that if you want someone to become interested in you, you have to be appear uninterested. Doesn't mean that you don't tell them who you are so they know who you that you exist. And this could be in the context of dating. This could be in the context of professional development. This could be in the context of trying to win a deal or travel somewhere or do whatever. You have to be able to appear cool, because if you appear needy pushes people away. But you'd think that if you want to let someone know who you are and what you want, you have to kind of be obvious about it. And that's not the truth, man. You talk to any girl out there, they'll tell you that a needy guy is like the biggest turnoff, right? You talk to any employer out there, the guy who's like, oh my God, I need to work for you, blah, 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 blah. I did that a little bit with Belljam, but I spread it out. Every 3 months I reached out, not every 3 days. You gotta let it breathe a little bit and be cool. Like, you got other shit going on. The second one here is, if you want free space or free time in your life, you have to have structure. Structure equals freedom. Discipline equals freedom. Jocko Willink talks about this a lot, where it's like, if you want the ability to be free, you have to have structure. You have to have routines. You have to have things you do all the time. Structure equals freedom. The freedom exists within the confines of that structure because it allows you to have predictability. Predictability is what gives you liberty, what gives you freedom. If you have predictability in your finances, in your health, in your relationships, in where you're going to be and what you're going to do, well, guess what? Then you have these gaps where you can do what you actually want to do. But if everything is chaos, you don't know when you're going to get paid next, you don't know when you're going to be healthy, you don't know where you're going to eat, of course there's no liberty in that. There's no freedom in that, because it's anarchy. It's the opposite of freedom. But freedom is undergirded by this system of discipline. The same way that liberty in the United States and in Western societies is undergirded by a constitution or a charter of rights and freedoms. Like, you need to have structure before you have freedom. It's not an obvious idea. Here's the next one. We do not show vulnerability to others because we are afraid we will look weak. But when we see others being vulnerable, we think they are strong. And I'm learning this the hard way, because with my podcast, this show, what I've learned is the most impactful episodes to people, just based on feedback, anecdotal data, is the episodes where I'm the most vulnerable. But I want to appear strong. I want to talk about all my successes and all my triumphs on this show, but nobody gives a shit about that. Everyone connects with the comeback story. Everyone connects with what you screwed up on more than what you did good. Because if you pat yourself enough on the back, there's no more room for their hand. So being vulnerable is not an obvious thing to do. We're taught to be strong, especially men. We're taught to not cry. We're taught to, big boys don't cry. We're taught to be strong, right? But honestly, being vulnerable is the best thing you can do. Being honest, being straightforward, right? Not delaying. What they say in The Godfather, if you have bad news to share with me, share it quick. I'll never forget when I first started out at Belljam. I was so nervous every single day that when I was asked to do a scope of work or talk to a contractor or someone from the city, I literally had no idea what to do. I would Google information about what to say on the call before the meeting started. And then on the meeting, they'd ask questions and I'd be like, listen, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm new and I don't know what I'm doing very much. Like, I'm going to be able to help you as much as I can, but these are my knowledge gaps. Hopefully you can work with me on this. And you know what? Man, they were so awesome. Like, you'd be surprised. If you just keep it real with the people, 100, you know, they might be a little frustrated if they're an asshole, but most people are going to be like, that's all good, man. Thanks for letting me know. As opposed to just winging it and assuming that you know what you're talking about. Man, people want to help you. People love doing favors for people. You ever go to a new city or a new country and ask for directions? People love to give you directions. People love to help you out because it's the best thing you can do. In negotiations, that's one of the tactics negotiators use, is they ask for a favor. Hey, can I borrow that pen? Hey, how are you doing? Hey, can we push this back about 10 minutes? Hey, would you mind like looking over my stuff? Like, people love to do favors for people because it's a sense of reciprocity. It's a sense of giving, right? People love to give more than they like to receive, even if you think you like to receive more. Here's the next one. When you don't have time to exercise or meditate, that's exactly when you need to exercise and meditate the most. People who have busy schedules, people who work 80, 90 hours a week, which is not many of them, but I'm sure they're out there. Those people need exercise and meditation the most. When I hear people say, like, I don't have time to exercise, you know, I immediately think to myself, and sometimes I say, you can't afford not to exercise, bro. Or back in the day, I remember I didn't want to read a book or something, and I had this mentor guy who was like teaching me about finance. And I said, listen, man, like, I don't really have time to read this book. It was like a finance book. And he goes, Akeem, you don't have time not to read it. He's like, people out there want to eat your lunch. There's people around the country, there's people around the world who are going to read this book the second they are asked to, because there's information and they got the serious hunger on to take on the world, and you're telling me you don't have time? It's not that you don't have time, it's that you don't have enough. And the reason you don't have enough is because you keep saying no to these kinds of things. So when people say exercise and meditate, I don't have time for that. Well, why do you think you don't have time? Do you think that's a problem? Do you think that the fact that you don't have time for 10 minutes even of a workout or 10 minutes of meditation is a problem? Do you think you should maybe address that? Like, man, that should be a wake-up call. That should be a cry for help, that if you can't meditate or exercise, that's what you need, right? That you need it more than everything. You should drop everything you're doing and do that if you can't exercise and meditate. Because health is wealth. Whatever you're not, whatever you need to do instead of the exercise and meditation, you'll be able to do more of and do it better once you exercise and meditate, because you have more clarity. The next one, the more you try and control someone, the further they will slip from your grasp. You ever been out of a relationship and you try to contact them or see what's going on, or hey, how are you, blah, 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 try to chase them down? The more you do that, the more they're going to run away. And this applies for everything, right? The more, like I said earlier, what you pursue eludes you. Whatever you're trying to get, it will run from your grasp. You have to attract things. You have to attract, like for Station Park, for example, when we started that project, we did so much outbound. I was looking through my emails the other day. We did probably 350 outbound emails asking people to consider leasing space at Station Park. Back then, we were selling hopes and dreams because the building wasn't built yet. But guess what? I'd say maybe 5 or 6 people in the last month from those 250, mind you, this is still a numbers game, from those 250 or 300 emails I sent out 3 years ago, 5 or 6 have come back once they've seen the building getting built and saying, hey, we're ready to do this now. We weren't 3 years ago for whatever reason, but so much of life is about timing. But I didn't go after them all like, hey, 2 months later after they said no or didn't respond, to say, hey, what's going on? Like, you need to follow up, but you don't want to be annoying. So if you build yourself up while you ask, in good time, the people who are meant to be there and the opportunities that are meant to be there will be there. This one kind of ties back into the one I was talking about with exercising and meditating, but this next one is called exercising when you're tired gives you more energy. I'm too tired to go to the gym. This is one of the most obvious counterintuitive ideas I think most people get. The idea of the gym is to get more energy. You think that you're going to get tired when you go and work out, but the opposite happens. You get the blood flow going, you get the mojo going, right? You get the brown sugar just sprinkled throughout your body. Every time I've gone to the gym, and this is without fail, every time I've gone to the gym in my life, when I was tired, I left with energy. I didn't leave tired. I left fired up because the blood was pumping. My free T was soaring, right? I was ready to go to space. But when you're on the way to the gym, that's the hardest part, because you're tired. Like, what am I doing here? I'm not going to be able to lift a single weight. But as soon as you get going, man, the body is an amazing machine. The body is designed by Mother Gaia to do some amazing shit. Anybody who's run a marathon, or anyone who's pushed themselves, or anyone who's done like a Spartan race will be able to tell you, hey, listen, the body's capable of way more than you think it is. And a little bit of exhaustion and tiredness on the way to the physical activity is the weakest cheese in the world, right? If you're exhausted, the last thing you want to do is exercise, but it's usually the one thing that will wake up and give you more energy. Energy output equals energy downgrade. Actually, energy output equals energy inflow. It's like you're creating a vacuum for more energy to come in when you push the weights, when you lift the weights, when you go on the run, when you go on the walk. So that concludes the internet's counterintuitive ideas, and these are my counterintuitive ideas. Hunters and conservation. I recently just took my PAL course for unrestricted firearms license, and I passed. And I learned a lot about guns. I learned a lot about gun safety, conservation, animals, just kind of the state of gun ownership in Canada. And I learned a lot. And the one thing that they said during the presentation was that hunters are the biggest conservationists because they need something to hunt. When I was growing up, I used to hear some people say, oh, hunters are evil. Hunters are killing animals in the bush. Little innocent Bambi running for her life, and the hunter comes and kills him. Like the Bambi movie, Disney, that's one of the most evil characters in the history of cinema, because he kills Bambi's mom, and then Bambi has to go make creatures in the forest and survive. Well, yes, killing an animal, it is sad with their family around and all this kind of stuff, but we've been doing this. We were hunter-gatherers, people. We were hunter-gatherers, and we've only got better at hunting as time has gone on, not worse. And by better, I mean, we're not chasing 1,500 buffalo off a cliff and then only eating like a third of them. We are very strategic. Hunters want to be able to hunt the year after and the year after that to get free meat. So of course they're going to be invested in the ability for animals to continue to be out there. So Ducks Unlimited, Hunters Guides, the government of Alberta, they have these, you have to buy a ticket to kill an animal, and there's only so X amount of tickets given out every single year. Or tags, I mean. You have to get a tag, right? And there's only X amount of whitetail tags. There's only X amount of moose tags. There's actually lotteries for the very rare animals, like the bighorn sheep, bison. Actually, the lady at the course was telling me that her brother won the lotto for the bison tag. And for non-First Nations people, there's only 40 allowed. Or 40 tags for the entire province of Alberta were given for bison hunts. And this girl's brother got one of those tags. So they're super excited because they're going to go out and get a bison. But bison are very heavily protected, right? Because their populations are low. But if we didn't have these systems in place that mostly hunters kind of organize and coordinate and finance, there'd be no animals left. And guess who would suffer the most? The hunters. Obviously, extinct animals are not great either. But here's a few cases of kind of what's happening. In North America, in 1907, there was only 41,000 elk. Thanks to the money and hard work invested by hunters to restore and conserve the habitat, elk numbers grew back to 550,000 by 1984. So between 1907 and 1984, there was almost 500,000 elk added to the population because of hunters' efforts. And that was in 1984. Today, there's over a million elk. Over a million, and they're not the football players. Here's another one. In 1900, there was only 500,000 whitetails in North America. But thanks to the work and conservation of hunters, now there are more than 30 million. So this is why it's a counterintuitive idea. These are the same people who are trying to protect these things and animals and conservation and population numbers are the ones going out and hunting them, killing them. But the vast majority of these hunters are not going out there and killing them and just letting them rot. They're going out there and collecting the meat. They're eating the animal. They obviously like the taste of it, so they want to go out there and hunt it some more. And if the day came where they couldn't hunt it because the population was dwindling, they'd be the first people to put and institute rules and regulations on the number of animals that could be hunted. The people killing them are the people protecting them, the hunters. The next one, loggers and tree planters. You'd think that loggers, people harvesting trees, and you always see these documentaries about people in the Amazon, and obviously this is country by country, but in North America, loggers are the biggest planters of trees, and they're the biggest financiers of tree planting operations. If you go to any logging company in Alberta, they normally have a wing or a division dedicated to the conservation of replanting the areas that they clear cut. I remember last year we went hunting, Mike took us into this like clearing. It was a really sketchy area. It was like kind of like dark. I thought a grizzly bear was going to jump out and kill us, but he's like, yeah, there's this area, there's this opening, there's this huge clearing. These loggers came through and cut down the area, and this is a huge cool clearing. We can get a lot of whitetail over there. So we're walking through this bush looking for this clearing, and lo and behold, the whole area that was clear cut for loggers was planted, replanted with new trees. The same company that came and cut down all these trees came back and planted new ones. And it's because in 5-10 years, the same company will come back and harvest those trees, right? So you'd think that the logging industry is going to remove all the trees on the face of the planet, and there's not going to be any trees left and blah, 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 blah. But if you don't go another level deep in that analysis and realize that the same people who are cutting down the trees have a serious financial incentive to replace them, you'd realize that they're not the evil loggers you'd maybe make them out to be. Really, all this comes down to is incentives. Like, if you're going to start a company, think about the incentives more than anything with the employees. Think about the incentives for loggers. Are they incentivized to clear cut every single tree on the face of the planet without replacing one for one? Does that make any sense? They wouldn't be in business for very long. If they clear cut the entire earth of trees, well, that was a good, we made lots of money, but now there's nothing. What are we going to do now? We have to go cut down bushes because we ran out of trees. We didn't repopulate it. The next one I got here is a very contentious, and I'm probably going to piss some people off here, but is racism. And during the Black Lives Matter movement in the summer of love 2020, when there was riots across the country, all over the United States, everyone was talking about racism, racism, racism. And I do believe racism is real. I do believe it exists. But I like what Morgan Freeman says here, and I'm going to clip him in. And if you don't know who Morgan Freeman is, it's the "when I was born, I was already 60" guy. It's the guy from your favorite movie, The Shawshank Redemption. It's your guy from your second favorite movie, Bruce Almighty, where he plays God. This guy, Morgan Freeman, is the coolest cat in Hollywood. And he came up through real racism, Jim Crow in the South, Memphis. That's where he grew up, and he was born in the 20s or 30s. Like, he's in his late 80s now. But he grew up with real racism. But I like what he says here. I'm going to tune him in.
Black History Month, you find
ridiculous.
Why?
You're going to relegate my history to a month?
Oh, come on.
What do you do with yours? Which month is White History Month? Come on, tell me.
Well, I'm Jewish.
Okay, which month is Jewish History Month?
There isn't one.
Oh, why not?
Yeah.
You want one?
No.
I don't either. I don't want a Black History Month. Black history is American history.
How are we going to get rid of racism?
Stop talking about it. I'm going to stop calling you a white man.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask you to stop calling me a black man. I know you as Mike Wallace. You know me as Morgan Freeman. You understand what I know this white guy named Mike Wallace. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
I think it's a very counterintuitive idea to think that if you don't want to get rid of racism, then don't stop talking about it. If you want to get rid of racism, then stop talking about it. You ever thought about communication in a relationship? The reason why a lot of relationships break down is because there's a failure to communicate. It's because when you don't talk about stuff in a relationship, it doesn't happen, right? If you don't bring up things that are bothering you, it doesn't get addressed. But what if the problem you're trying to address wasn't a problem in the first place? Racism, I believe, is taught. I think it's taught when people are kids, and then it's taught from those kids to their kids, and it's a generational education system. But it's not based in anything that isn't taught. We all became different races because of the way we migrated out of the Sumerian area of East Africa. And then we expanded into Samaria and Northern and Southern. And then people went over the Bering Strait over into North America. These different geographies created different skin tones because obviously if you're more Northern, you're going to have less sunlight. You're going to be able to absorb less. If you're going to a northern area, like let's say the people who came out of East Africa went north, they don't have as much sun and sun exposure as the people in the south, in Africa, in the Caribbean, the tropics. Therefore, any sun that they do get, they have to maximize with the melatonin in their skin. So they evolutionarily developed lighter skin tones to absorb as much sun as possible. Where the opposite happened for the people who went south or went towards the kind of like around the equator. Those people in Africa or anywhere around the equator, around the globe, they adapted darker skin because they were in the sun more. So they were trying to block the amount of rays and have developed more melatonin because they didn't need to absorb the maximum amount of sun because they had more access to sun. The sun was beating down on them constantly more as opposed to the north. So skin tones developed out of geography, not out of some racist tendencies that people might believe, which is like, oh, they have the X skin color, so they are X tendency, or they are X whatever, right? These ideas, tropes, and stereotypes are educated to people. But if we continue to talk about it and talk about everything being racist or this and this and this and this politically correct stuff where we have to kind of bring up race and everything, or you have to stand up and declare your race, like, how is that solving the problem? I think we'd be better off if we acknowledge people for who they are as individuals, like Martin Luther King said, as opposed to what they say we should be saying people as, like, oh, these people are X color. Like, lately I've been applying for different stuff, and some of these applications, they ask you to denounce who you are. Are you male, female? What is your race? Are you black, African American, blah, 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 blah? Are you Hispanic? And then they ask you if you're handicapped or whatever. Like, this identity selection, what does that have to do with me getting the job? Doesn't the job or doesn't the application for whatever I'm applying for have more to do with my ability to do the job? I don't know. Anyways, I don't want to be judged because I'm black, and I don't want favors because I'm black. I want favors because I'm good at what I am and I'm a good person and my name's Akeem. And the opposite is true. I don't want to be discriminated against because I'm black. I want to be discriminated against because if I am discriminated against, it's because I'm doing bad stuff. Or because I'm doing people wrong, or because I'm not good at whatever it is I'm being asked to do. Judge me by my actions and my merits only. And let's stop talking about racism. Here's the next one. Forest fires and a healthy forest. Forest fires in the last 2-3 years have been dog whistle for environmentalists and climate change activists to yell uncle about what's going on with global warming and all this other stuff. And yes, there's probably some truth to that, although I'm very, very doubtful about the science that they provide about how accurate it is. All I'm saying is, how can someone know for sure? But that doesn't discredit what they're saying about these forest fires. Here's the thing with forest fires. Not all forest fires are bad. The forest fires that are actually useful are the ones that are called controlled burns. And the reason why forest fires are good is because it creates a healthy forest. A healthy forest is not healthy if it has diseased trees or if it has overgrown fauna of dead trees that are blocking sun from getting to the floor bed of the forest, of the woods, for these actual like healthy organisms to be able to do photosynthesis with the sunlight, right? If they can't access the sun because it's being blocked out by dead or diseased trees, well, then everything dies. It becomes a cancer in the forest. So governments, institutions, different organizations and governing bodies will do controlled burns. Now, where it gets out of hands is the incompetence, right? That's where it becomes a dangerous thing. Instead of doing a controlled burn of like a specific area marked off, they'll do a controlled burn of a specific area marked off and not have the right precautions in place to not let the fire spread out of control. Crazy. And obviously that's bad. So get the fires under control, but forest fires are not all bad. As a matter of fact, it's probably the healthiest thing that an ecosystem can do to cleanse itself. Sometimes you have to scorch earth to renew the earth. And forest fires happen organically without us, by the way. Before governments got involved or any organizations, they were called lightning. Lightning and thunder would hit a forest, completely kill it off and start a fire, forest fire, and then it would stop, and then out of that, ashes would grow a new forest. So it's not obviously, maybe this is less of a counterintuitive idea as if it's just like common sense. And here's the last and final thing I'll talk about is this idea of making mistakes and how making mistakes is the point. And I'll use an idiom out of Silicon Valley, which is where all the tech in the world, really all the technological advancements in the last 10 years, 20 years has really been centered, which is these tech companies. And one of them is Mark Zuckerberg. Now, I'm kind of lukewarm about Mark Zuckerberg. I think he's got his issues. And this is the guy who started Facebook and Instagram. Everyone I know is addicted to Instagram. But anyways, Mark Zuckerberg said this: the biggest risk is not taking any risk. In a world that is changing really quickly, the only strategy that is guaranteed to fail is not taking risks. Now, what is he saying by that? He's saying move fast and break things. He's saying the idea is not to succeed. The idea is to fail as fast as possible. Right? A mistake is a win. Speed is key. Quantity over quality. Failure is the point. Every no is closer to a yes. And the faster you can get the no's, the faster you can get a yes. Sarah Blakely, who's the owner of Spanx, which is a multi-billion dollar company. She's one of the youngest female billionaires in the history of the United States. Spanx was just a brand that like tightened up women's curves so that they could fit into clothes better. Anyways, when she was growing up, her dad would sit around the dinner table and ask her, how many times did you fail today? And he didn't say it like a judgment. He was trying to prod Sarah and her brother to think about, have the right framing around failure, which is that failure is great. Failure is awesome because you're testing things. You're becoming a mad scientist. You're realizing what doesn't work. Right? Thomas Edison in a light bulb, 1,000 failures until he figured out how to make the light bulb. And when he was asked about it, he said, I didn't have 1,000 failures. I figured out 1,000 ways not to make the light bulb. And this mentality is super, super, super helpful. Where if you approach the world where everything you do and everything you fail at is a good thing, it's going to rewire you and it's going to make you unstoppable, man. You're going to crush it in the free enterprise system, depending on what you want to do. As an artist, someone in the workforce, doing your own company, in the exercise realm, right? The idea here is not to succeed. The idea is just to try. Because a lot of people just don't even do that. They don't even take the risk. They don't even go for it. And the fear of failure kills them, right? My buddy, when we were growing up, when I was 18, 19, 20 years old, my buddy Ryan would take me to the bar and he'd be like, Hakeem, he'd see that I was a little scared talking to the girls. Imagine that, me being scared. He's like, Hakeem, the only way we're going to have fun tonight is if you get 20 no's. And by no, we're talking about like going up to a girl at the bar and asking her if she wants to dance or something. Like, don't be affected by being rejected. That mentality. And Ryan, actually, for whatever, I'm not going to say his last name, but this guy was amazing. He danced with girls all night. He got a lot of numbers. He was successful. And that's because he just didn't give a shit. He's like, I didn't come out here to pick up chicks. I came out here to have fun with my friends. But if I want to see a talk to a girl, I'm just going to do it. And if she says no, whatever. That's not why I came out. But he was trying to say, don't be affected by being rejected. The idea here is to get, like, let's get 20 no's. We go to a country bar and he's like, let's get 20 no's right now. And it removes the fear, because if the objective is failure, then you become unstoppable. You become fearless, as opposed to getting success, because if you have to get success, then you're afraid of failure. That's why the school system, circling back to what I was saying about the school system earlier, is like, the school system teaches you to pass. The school system teaches you that failure is bad. That is the wrong framing for you to become successful in the real world, because you're going to fail. All you're going to do in life is fail, but you're going to fail forward. And if you don't have a healthy mentality around failure, you're not going to make it very far. I want you to fail. I want you to take chances. I want you to not be afraid of fucking up, because it's going to happen. And the only thing that's going to stop you from taking the next chance, swing at the bat, is whether you think that was a success, the failure was a success, and not the other thing, or not the other way around. Winston Churchill, who led Britain and really the rest of the world through World War II, and he was the leader, Prime Minister of Britain during the World War II days, he said his definition of success was going from failure to failure with great enthusiasm. And I think that's a great way to end this show, because if you go from failure to failure with great enthusiasm, you'll be able to look any counterintuitive idea in the face and say, you know what, I'm gonna do the opposite. Until next time, keep your stick on the ice. Peace.